DAWU has worked with the Office for Disability to produce the Disability Advocacy by the Numbers report. If you haven't got a copy, there's copies at the registration desk, so please help yourself. And I would like to invite Llewellyn Reinders, the Policy Officer of Victorian Council of Social Services, to come and speak to the report and to lead the strategic planning session. Welcome, Llewellyn.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Can I just grab those documents? And we have the presentation up. Good morning, everyone. My name is Llewellyn Reinders. I'm the Policy Manager at the Victorian Council of Social Service, and also have the pleasure of working with Melissa and Natasha to help from VCOS's end to deliver the Disability Advocacy Resource Unit. So I've got now about 50 minutes with you, and I want to talk through two kind of pieces of work that we've done and are doing. The first is our Disability Advocacy by the Numbers report. Many of you may have been here at the May session where I gave you a bit of a sneak preview about what was being found in that report. We've now had the chance to publish it, and we can now give you kind of the final data and the findings of that report. The data for this report is provided by you. So all the organisations that report data to the Office for Disability through the Victorian Disability Advocacy Program, all that data has been collated, de-identified and given to DAWU to put together into this report. So we've done some of the analysis and we've laid out the report so that you can see the outcome of the data that you're providing. In addition to giving you the data so that you can see what's happening in the disability advocacy sector in Victoria, we've also done a supplementary report to dig into some of the issues about the data's quality, about what the data is telling us, and how we might think about making that data better in the future. We also include in the report some case studies that you have provided. That again is de-identified, so it's we don't identify the people in the case studies or the organisations that are working with those people, but it does give some insight into the kinds of issues and the kind of work that disability advocacy organisations are doing. But to really talk to the headline findings of that data report, we see that with Victorian Government disability advocacy funding, about 800 people are receiving services in a three-month period in Victoria. Many of those people will be worked with over a number of months, so they may appear in different three-month periods, but about half of those people in a three-month period are new clients. So around 400 new clients are being provided services in Victoria funded by the Victorian Government. There are slightly more men and boys than women and girls, and that's an interesting finding that in over the four-year period covered by this data, we find that in all but one reporting period, organisations reported working with more men than they did with women. Those numbers are only slight, but given that women make up a slight majority of the population, as well as given the age cohort of people with disability, we do find it interesting that men are receiving more services than women from the data that we've collected. We have seen a trend over the last 4 years of more and more young people receiving disability advocacy services. There have been quite a sharp increase in the numbers of young people accessing disability advocacy services. And we also see that from the data that's been reported, around 4% of people receiving services are from an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander background. Given about 1% of Victorians are from an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander background, that is quite a good representation. And around 10% were reported as being from a culturally or linguistically diverse background. Yes?
Young people, do you mean children?
So the particular, if you look at page 11 of the report, we see the biggest kind of change is that yellow line, which is 15 to 24 year olds. So particularly in that kind of end of high school, early adulthood group, we are seeing quite a large increase, particularly in the last year, of that cohort accessing services, which we do find quite interesting. Moving on, the most popular topics, and I think I showed you a draft of this diagram last time, are disability services and education. Quite clearly, those both together make up over 40% of the people accessing services, followed by accommodation, legal and health. And it's interesting to compare that that's actually quite a difference. There's similarities, but is actually quite a different spread to the data that we're getting from the National Disability Advocacy Program, and particularly the prominence of education issues in Victoria is much higher than we're seeing in the nationally funded program. So I find that quite interesting. I think in part of the handouts, there's a similar diagram to this showing the spread of federally funded services on a national basis. Other big topics are accommodation, legal and health. And those groupings have been stable for a number of years. So we're not seeing a lot of change. And I think for some time, those five issues have made up the vast majority, about two-thirds of the issues that people receiving services are facing. In particular, we've identified two issues as there being a clear trend of increasing. The first is disability services in the NDIS, which is unsurprising given the rollout of the NDIS as it rolls out across the state. So we've seen a clear trend in those issues increasing. And the other one is legal issues that we've seen a reasonably clear trend over the last 4 years of increasing recourse to disability advocacy services for legal issues. You'll see in the report we've actually provided the individual data for each advocacy issue to look at how that plays out over time. So for example, this is the data we've been provided with on accommodation issues. We've said that this is broadly stable over the 4 years, but we have seen an interesting uptick just in that final quarter, which was the June quarter of last year. So we will need to see this year's set of data to see whether that trend is increasing, but certainly over the 4 years of the data that we've got, there's a broadly stable trend in accommodation issues. And we have that set of data. You can look through the report and kind of see any trends in the data over a four-year period. I've mentioned the interesting kind of gender split in the data. The other thing that's interesting to point out that when we compare with Australian Bureau of Statistics data for Victoria about the age of people with disability, those blue columns there, we actually find that, you know, about 40% of people who say that they have a severe or profound impairment or a disability of some kind are over the age of 65, but we see very few people over the age of 65 approaching disability advocacy services. Where, you know, we can't tell from the data why that is. We've suggested that perhaps they are seeking other types of advocacy, such as aged care advocacy, for example. But it is interesting that whereas every other age group is overrepresented compared to their proportions in the population, that that older people who do have disabilities appear not to be approaching disability advocacy services. Just before I get into some of the data issues, and they're from, you know, because I'm a bit of a nerd, I actually find them really interesting. But are there any questions just about the detail of some of the data that's come out?
I just want to know how you deal with complex issues. So a person presents with, you know, all of these different problems.
Sorry, if a person presents with a whole range of complex problems, have you included them in the main area that they've come for advocacy services about? Or, you know, so if they've got an accommodation issue, they've got an education issue, they've got a health issue, how have you managed those within the data?
So we have gone off what organisations reported. So the only data we have is what organisations put on their QDC form. So that comes to some of the data issues that we have, is that we don't have a clear way of saying how should you classify people. And that's a clear example that where a person presents with multiple issues, some agencies might pick the main issue, other agencies might pick multiple issues and report the same person against multiple different topics. It's unclear from the data and we can't tell because we haven't kind of had the conversation amongst ourselves about, well, how do we manage those complexities in the data? So, you know, the reality is I really can't answer that question. And we don't have a measure of complexity of need that we're able to report. Any other questions? Right here.
I guess I just wanted to point out that the reason that there's probably not much going on in the 65 plus range is because mostly we're not funded to work with people over 65. So they might contact us, in which case we would say, we can't work with you, go here, here and here. But we wouldn't necessarily record their contact and the referrals that we'd made.
Any other questions or queries? I do want to move on then very quickly to looking at some of the data issues, because we're going to start a process. We're in some conversations with the Office for Disability at the moment about the best way to proceed with that, but do want to start a process and open up a broader conversation, which we'll come back to you, about how we might improve the data collection process or even look at other ways of synthesising and recording information about disability advocacy in the future. Because the reality is, as much as we've kind of done our best with the data that we've got, it is only telling us part of the story, and also it is very variable in the quality of data that we're receiving. So we're really interested, and I believe the Office for Disability is as well, in having a conversation about how we can improve that process, how we can potentially improve and change the QDC form, but also look at other avenues for recording information so that we get a better idea of what's going on in the disability advocacy sector, what people are approaching the sector about, what the issues people are raising are, as well as the effectiveness of the advocacy sector in resolving those issues. So we've kind of gone through, and you can, you know, read the report itself and kind of identified what are the data quality issues, but more generally, why are we collecting this data? There's a certain number of pieces of information that are required by various government departments and agencies to, you know, tick off the money that has been spent, but there's an awful lot of other things that we're collecting data about, and it's often unclear why we're collecting or what we're trying to achieve by collecting that data. So part of the conversation we want to have with you is, what do we think is important for us to know about disability advocacy so that we can design ways of collecting information that actually give us that answer? What we see is that actually we're only able to report in this document only about a third of the data items that are in the Q2EC report for a variety of different reasons. So there's a lot of extra data that you've been providing that either because of quality issues or because of other sensitivities, we're not even able to report back. And I guess there's a question about, are those useful or not? And then secondly, just even bedding down some of the actual questions that are asked, and we've actually put the full list of questions that are asked in the back of this report, whether they're the most useful. We are very aware that the QDC is a really intensive data collection process. We identified around 200 different pieces of information that organisations are asked to provide through that data collection process, and that they need to do that every 3 months. So that's a very intensive data collection ask for what are often quite small amounts of funding. And we do think there's probably the opportunity to streamline that, actually make some of that data collection simpler and easier, to take some of the red tape burden off the sector, as well as actually collect clearer pieces of information that isn't duplicating across the data collection process. The other thing we observe is because somewhat unusually, organisations are asked to report on whomever they're working with at the time, regardless of whether they've reported the details of that person previously. So what we see is there is a lot of duplication in the reporting, that organisations are asked to report the same information about the same people over and over again because they had to work with that person for 2 years and have therefore provided that information 8 times over 8 different data collection cycles. We think there's a lot of unnecessary reporting burden in the process that can actually be streamlined and make it simpler and easier for organisations to report. And the other thing we're quite aware is that in the data we received, there's actually a lot of missing information. So, for example, nearly half of the information about gender was not reported in the data we received. Nearly half the information about the age group of people receiving services was not reported in the data collection process. So we also want to have a conversation to understand why that data isn't being reported and what can be done to make that easier. I'm aware that we have limited time, but I'm actually interested if people have any first thoughts. Obviously, we will have other opportunities in the future to discuss some of the detail of this, but do people have initial thoughts or comments about any of that? What we will do in the future, we'll come back to you and talk about a number of these questions, but actually, you know, getting a handle on what information we want to know, where the data comes from, like do organisations all have computerised systems that they're just pulling the data out of, or are there other ways that people are generating this data, what information should be made public and reported back to the sector through this process. How we write the right questions to ask, because certainly we think some of the questions that are asked are a bit unclear in what they're actually asking organisations to provide. And particularly around some other types of advocacy, the QDC is very focused on individual advocacy, and that is mostly what the data that we are able to present is. But how do we collect information about systemic group and self-advocacy activities? We really don't have a good handle on information around that, so we're interested in having conversations about, well, how do we collect that information? How do we present what those organisations are doing in a meaningful way that actually explains what's happening. And then particularly getting an understanding of how do we measure demand in the sector? What is the demand for disability advocacy and how can we record that? And also, what is the outcomes of disability advocacy? They're quite difficult and complicated questions, but we think it's worth having a conversation about how we can get better at looking at what is the product of disability advocacy rather than just information about who is accessing it. Okay, and just to finish that conversation off, part of the reason that we want to engage in this process is there's a particularly opportune time at the moment. Firstly, we've had a recent review of the Victorian Disability Advocacy Program, and there's the opportunity, I guess, to act on some of the outcomes of that review. And also that the Victorian government's actually made a number of promises around improving issues to do with the program. So particularly the measurement of demand and outcomes, building stronger links with other safeguarding mechanisms and simplifying the administrative requirements on organisations. So there are commitments from the Minister, from the Victorian Government, to actually improve these issues within the Disability Advocacy Program. So this is an opportunity for us really to feed in and have some influence on how those recommendations are implemented. Okay, I'm going to move on and just talk to you a bit more about DARU. We're very aware, as you all would be, that we're all coming to the end of our three-year funding cycles. And in anticipation, obviously none of us have actually had our funding confirmed for beyond the 30th of June, but in anticipation that DARU will continue on beyond that date, we're starting our strategic planning process. And really want to have a bit of a chat to you about what we might do in the future, what you think is good and bad about DARU, what is valuable about DARU, what isn't, and what we can do better and where you would like us to go in our future directions to help support you in doing your work. Just to start at the end, on your tables you will see a bit of a handout with these five questions on it. So it's a bit of an old school SWOT analysis, but we did want to kind of maximise your chances to have some input. So if you did want to, while I'm talking and while we're having a bit of a chat, jot down any thoughts that you had on anything that you'd like to comment about the work of DARU or where we should be looking at trending in the future, please do so. And we can collect those up at the end of the session and incorporate that information as well. Okay, but more generally, the vision of DARU, or at least the vision that we adopted as part of our last strategic plan, was that DARU wants a society where people with disability are fully included, their inherent dignity and worth is recognised, and where their human rights are respected and upheld. Now, our mission to achieve that vision is to resource the work of disability advocacy in Victoria through targeted and responsive information provision, training and network support. So we very much see ourselves, and we are very much funded to be a support organisation, to be someone who doesn't do advocate on behalf of the sector, but in fact supports the sector to advocate. We're really interested in whether you think we're being effective at supporting you, whether the information that we provide, the training and the networking opportunities we provide are effective, and whether there's other things that you think would be useful for DARU to be engaging in that would make your lives and your jobs and your organisations easier. So a recap of our last strategic plan, which I believe is available on our website, we identified four basic areas of work where we would concentrate our efforts. So firstly, in supporting disability advocacy, and particularly about preparing disability advocates in an NDIS environment, and supporting collaboration for systemic change. And we've undertaken a number of projects over the last 3 years that have actually sought to provide information and advice on the NDIS, as well as bringing advocates together where there were systemic advocacy opportunities to be able to share information, discuss the issues, and at times feed into a joint or a peak body submission, particularly around issues on disability advocacy and disability advocacy funding. Capacity building. We deliver training. Many of you generously take that training up, as well as convening these types of forums. And also developing materials to assist advocates with their work. The third is providing an information gateway. Probably the feedback I've heard over a number of years is that our regular weekly update is highly valued for the sector, being able to bring together all the things that have happened over the last week, the opportunities, the media, the jobs, you know, all of that kind of nuts and bolts of what's going on, who's where, and what's happening and what opportunities are available is highly valued. And also our website, which has undergone quite a considerable revamp over the last year, and is now hopefully much easier for you to find information that you need. And finally, pulling together forums like this, pulling together our conference, and supporting networks of disability advocates to come together and talk about their work and to share and develop linkages and networks to be able to work more cohesively as a sector. So really I want to use the last few minutes of the session to open it up a bit to you and really to understand your perspectives of who we are and what you think is valuable about what we do, what you think we can do better, and where you would like to see both DARU and the sector more generally head in the next few years. We're very aware that at the moment, you know, we have quite a supportive Victorian government, whereas we see other state governments defunding disability advocacy. The Victorian government has committed to maintain disability advocacy, and indeed we have high hopes that they will increase disability advocacy funding in the future. So we think we have a strong foundation on which to build, but we also are interested in hearing, well, where do you want us to go from that foundation? How would you like to see the sector change in the future? And in particular, what can DARU do to help facilitate that change? Does anyone have any thoughts on kind of any of those issues, but particularly what you think is next for disability advocacy that we can help with? I think it's... Do people have any thoughts? Would people feel...
Office for Disability, Mark Figan. Whether you'd like us to leave from the office for this session or not.
I've never known disability advocates to be shy. but, you know, let's say that this is Chatham House rules and... those from the Office for Disability over here won't go back and dob on you and write down that Organisation X said nasty things. Fantastic. But I think there was a comment.
A question. Just wondering, do you actually report on the outcomes of the advocacy? And my question, I guess, is leading to... Given that the other states, as you've mentioned, are not necessarily funding ongoing advocacy and given the importance of advocacy, perhaps DARU could start monitoring its impact or the impact of the advocates and capturing that and reporting it. Just a safety measure for the future. Plus, of course, it'll be very informative to see what kind of impact advocates actually have in employment, accommodation, education, and all the other matters that you raised.
Yeah, no, that's... So, at the moment, yeah, we don't collect... the Office for Disability doesn't actually collect data on impact or outcomes. They are tricky to measure, but that being said, yeah, I think it's an important thing, both through, I guess, our discussion about data, but even more generally, how do we document and kind of prove the value of disability advocacy? I suspect Mary will have something to say about some of these issues after lunch. And, you know, I think there's a lot of work that Dana is doing that we can build on in that direction. But I think it's a really good point and a good question because most of the kinds of impact information or outcome information at the moment is really quite anecdotal. We have some great case studies and we have some great kind of anecdotal evidence about here is what the intervention of a disability advocacy service was able to produce in a particular person's trajectory, but we don't necessarily have great ways to scale that up.
And I was going to add perhaps technology and the advances in technology through apps and all sorts of things would actually help it make easier to capture that follow-through data and centralise it so that you can have access to it.
Yes, no, I completely agree.
Thank you. I hope you don't want me to leave. I'm Colleen from VDAC. I'm just come today just to listen, but I feel it's really pertinent to, with any strategic planning process, that talks to other high-level plans. So obviously the State Disability Plan, if you can talk back to a government saying, well, this is what you said you were going to do and this is what we need to do it, it obviously gives you more grounding and more connection. And there, you know, there are people that may not be as happy with other, you know, government plans or whatever, but that's what the government will make its decision on. That's what the funding is connected to, those plans. So the more that you can connect to that and talk back to that and certainly using similar language and saying, well, you know, the third pillar you said, and the measures and outcomes are being worked on at the moment. So I'd really encourage you to sort of consider that in the body of your document for the, and then that will hopefully mean that it does keep funding. And I think one thing to tell the government as well here in Victoria that we do it very well. Love to hear that, and that's always a great thing, and give evidence of that is obviously you're doing all those things, but just on behalf of VDAC, just thanking the sector, the, you know, advocacy sector, for what it does, and we're doing all we can to make sure that that message is being heard wherever anyone will listen. So thank you.
Fantastic, thank you. And yes, I think that's an excellent suggestion, and yeah, as part of our review process, we will kind of look at developments in Victorian government policy as well as nationally and kind of say, you know, do our own kind of, I guess, scenario planning and looking at, well, what are the opportunities in the future? But any thoughts on those, we're really interested in hearing.
Sorry, I should have introduced myself before. I'm Melinda Jones. I'm a consumer as much as anything else. I'm a retired human rights lawyer, but I still work in the area. One of my thoughts is that I don't think that the vast majority of people with disabilities or their carers have the slightest idea what disability advocacy, that it exists, and if it exists, what it can do and what it can't do. Following up from the point that was just made, it might be good to be looking at something with someone like Carers Australia or some of the consumer groups to maybe run forums through them to people who are potential users of services. So I think that's one thing that would be an additional sort of thing. The other thing is, going back to the question of outcomes, one of the things that, again, I'm interested in is this question of people with complex needs. So if you've got one very serious problem, you might think it's worth going to someone because they can help you solve that problem. And it would be really interesting to know if the people who go to advocates are people who are in crisis or not in crisis, whether they've come because there's a simple problem and they can sort of imagine that someone might have an answer to, compared to people who think the whole thing's too complicated, I don't even know who to talk to about this, and an advocate, the idea of an advocate never ever comes across their mind as one of the possible options.
Yeah, no, and I think that's an excellent observation, and certainly, you know, we often find that out in the broader world, disability advocacy is not necessarily well understood. It's not necessarily something that, you know, if people are encountering other parts of the community services sector, that people even necessarily think to refer a person to a disability advocate or to work with a disability advocacy organisation to help resolve a person's problem. The other thing, which is, you know, I guess common amongst a lot of underfunded and overstretched organisations, is that we don't necessarily go out and promote our services because we can't deal with all the people walking in the door. And why would we go and try and get more people to come in the door when we can't deal with the people who are already at it? It's a very interesting conundrum, but I think it is sometimes only when people are more aware that a service is available that the shortage of the service and the demand on the surface becomes more obvious, and there is more political will to be generated to actually do something about it.
So maybe we, Dara, could take on some sort of research project that looked at the unmet need for advocacy, or circumstances where advocacy potentially could make a massive difference and potentially a much cheaper alternative, for example, to going through courts. And, you know, maybe that's something that could be looked at by the sector.
Jeff Southall, Leadership Plus. Sort of on the back of that point, collectively what we do is a bit like what an ombudsman might do for this sector. We're effectively providing that service in terms of managing complaints and so forth. As the NDIS rolls out and as there's more pressure on service providers to become more concentrated, as I'm sure they will, there'll be sort of areas where there's pockets of real issues and pockets of real problems and problem organisations. If you look at the sort of industry ombudsmans around energy and telecommunications, one of their functions is to report what the complaint regime's like across each of those providers. We don't do that. You have the capacity to capture this information as sort of a centralised broker for that information. Is there any vision for doing that? And that potentially would help with the issue you're talking about before, because the profile of the whole sector gets raised, the advocacy sector, I should say, gets raised because we're able to report on that.
Yes, so certainly, I think, yes, there's part of that that we can do with the data that the Office for Disability collects. I think there's probably also, and it's an interesting idea about a conversation with the Disability Services Commissioner and ultimately the NDIS Quality and Safeguarding Commission around the publication of their data as well.
I think, given what history so far, we couldn't rely on the NDIA to be doing it right now.
Well, the Quality and Safeguarding Commission, which is yet to come into existence, but certainly that is proposed to be part of its role as well.
I mean, we collectively are uniquely positioned to capture that information, and there's no mechanism to do that right now. We don't report to any sector who the complaint was about other than NDIS other. So we don't say XYZ provider. Someday we're going to have to do that to provide that information.
Yes, excellent points.
I guess on a smaller level, one of the things that would be helpful as an advocate is having some centralised resources that actually document what the the rules, guidelines and legislation is in regards to specific issues. And I had a case a couple of years ago with a young woman with cerebral palsy who the hospital had imposed a not-for-resuscitation order on her, and it took me a year to unravel what the relevant legislation was, what the rules were, what the hospital ethics board had to say about it. And I made mistakes that I wouldn't have made had I known what the landscape looked like before that. And one of the things that would be helpful is having those resources on various topics actually at our fingertips. What does the Disability Act say about your right to challenge a notice to vacate? And to actually break that down and make it easier. And I think obviously advocates getting together, we can unravel a fair amount of that. What do you know about this? What do you know about that? But actually having a well-researched position on different advocacy issues would clear a lot of that up. And in fact, what I found out in that case is doctors can impose not-for-resuscitation orders. There's nothing you can do about it. It's their choice, not yours. And no, you don't have any rights. But it took me too long to figure that out before we could actually put a solution together in collaboration with the family and the hospital to try and at least get some kind of agreement about what should happen. So those kinds of cases, which are somewhat unusual, I guess, like we have so many different topics that come across our desk, it's like you're relearning the facts every single time someone presents you with something new, and it's time consuming in a way that I don't think it has to be.
Yeah, look, it's a really good point, and you're not the first to raise that issue. Part of the difficulty in the past has been you kind of often don't know what you need until you get there. And so to develop a knowledge bank of every conceivable advocacy issue is a big, big project. That being said, you know, I do wonder how we can better share our own expertise. For example, if somebody else now hit that situation that you've just spent a year researching, you would be able to give them an awful lot more information rather than them having to relearn all of that again. And I do wonder whether we can get better at kind of identifying key experts in particular issues across the disability advocacy sector, so that if you come across a particular issue, you can have some reference point of, is there anyone else who has come across this issue before, and can I talk to them and actually understand what they learnt dealing with that issue?
Sorry, specifically to that point, amongst the NDIS appeals advocates, we've started just an online chat group to address that particular exact question, because amongst the claims through the AAT, there's obviously a precedent set when it actually goes through to a full appeal and it gets documented and have a hearing, but most of them get settled beforehand. So we've started a sort of online session so people can just compare notes in order to do that, and it sounds like it's exactly what we need for this sort of, you know, so you can just search and say, you know, refusal of care or things like that on the particular topic. So, no, we're happy to invite you along. Talk to me. No worries.
Fantastic. Any other...
Sorry, again, it's Kathy Barakas here. Further to that point, online mentoring platforms are incredibly inexpensive and useful. Organisations like the accountants can actually, you know, and consultants can actually use them, and they just identify their expertise, and they're really easy to use, in the future. And the second point I wanted to raise is in terms of complaints and how you can gain visibility about the impact that advocacy can have. I'm just imagining the star rating system of the DES providers. If we could have some input into those that are getting complaints, that would perhaps give a fairer system or a more accurate picture of their work and their success.
Yes, no, it's an excellent point, and indeed one we have raised in the context of the Quality and Safeguarding Commission as well, that we certainly think the Commission should have a role in being able to publicly kind of determine the quality And rate the quality of organisations and have that information publicly available, rather than leaving, you know, it to individuals to each individually investigate the quality and status of the service providers that they're using. But I think it's an excellent point.
Oh, no, it's just further to the same thing. Forgive me if I don't know Daru's website well enough, but could there just be like a little section set up on that, questions of interest or something like that? And just whenever you get a topic like that, you just, everything that you've collected, you just put up and you send in, and somebody, I mean, if I can do this, like collect all the relevant articles and have, you know, the references, and just sort of send it around to people so that they know, surely there'd be someone, you just send it to, say, Daru, and they set up all the paperwork and the relevant links under this, say, questions of interest. So you know that if you've got a question like that, you go to the Daru questions of interest thing and you look down the topics, oh, okay, non-resuscitation, notices to vacate, and you know just it'll be all there. So if somebody else does X, Y, and Z extra, they send it in and it gets tacked on.
Yeah, look, we are certainly, I mean, we have started some initial thinking around how to do that. So, yes, it is an excellent idea and we will take it on board and kind of do some more thinking about how to do it in a... I mean, in the end, Daru is 1.5 people, so there's...
I can sort of set up like a little file, a little folder. I mean, I'm sort of a Luddite. I'm quite happy with the filing cabinet. Yeah. So, you know, if I can do this technically, there's a lot of people who are a lot more advanced than I am. And just, so I can set up like this file, that file, and that file, and each one has links to other bits and pieces as well. If you want to sort of go past what I did, these are the other links that this was attached to this particular article. So you just send the whole lot in together.
Yeah, look, it is certainly something we can investigate further, and we're happy to chat with you more about that idea. Yeah. I'm aware we're about at time. Are there any last kind of comments or questions? We will leave the handouts with you over lunch and collect them after lunch. So if you do have any other thoughts, even if it's just about, you know, I tried to use a website and it didn't work, or, you know, I got information that... or there was information that I wanted and you're not putting it in your newsletter, or there's particular training that we think would be really valuable for our organisation. Any ideas that you have about the work that we might do in the future would be very valuable. Thank you again for your time. Thank you for supporting Daru by coming along and using the opportunities we provide. And I will hand over quickly to Melissa to wrap up before lunch.
Thank you very much, Llewellyn, and thank you all for your input, and I hope you please do fill in your ideas. We want to make sure that Daru is as relevant as possible and is helpful to you in your work, particularly with lots of changes coming up and big workload coming forward with NDIS. So we will break for lunch at 12, which is now, and you've got an hour, so please be seated back at 1 o'clock.